From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In November of 2013, a high school student on an AC Transit bus in Oakland set fire to the skirt of an agender teen asleep on the way home from school. The incident sparked outrage and disbelief in the Bay Area. And here's a neighbor of Sasha, the victim, talking to KPIX News at the time.
Can't even fathom what would be going through their head when they do it, but it just saddens me incredibly.
And nearly 4 years later, journalist Dashka Slater has a book examining the people and lives behind the horrible event. She joins us to talk about her book, The 57 Bus, a true story of two teenagers and the crime that changed their lives. It's coming up next, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. 4 years ago, on an AC Transit bus in Oakland, a high school student set fire to the skirt of an agender teenager named Sasha, causing third-degree burns over nearly a quarter of Sasha's body. Journalist and author Dashka Slater tells the stories of the two students who collided that day in the 57 bus, a true story of two teenagers and the crime that changed their lives. And welcome to Forum, Dashka Slater.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And most of the Bay Area, maybe all over the world, know this story because it got so much attention. In fact, one of the stories that you write about is all that media attention, and maybe we can get to that in the course of this hour. But there are really two stories here, as I said in my introduction, and yet there are many other stories, all the people around them, their friends, their relatives, their family that you managed to tell. But let's talk about the characters first. The two principal characters. We call them protagonists because it does read in many ways like a novel. You've managed to accomplish here. Sasha is a prodigy, a wonderful imagination, gift of language, spends a lot of time playing games, and has Asperger's, is really in many ways brilliant, just minding their own business. And I use that pronoun because that is a pronoun that they prefer to be called by. And we talk about the whole agender identity. On the bus, reading Anna Karenina, falls asleep, and a young African-American kid literally sets her on fire, sets them on fire. So you have to get used to it.
Yeah, yeah. It was really a shocking event. I think all of us who live in the Bay Area who heard about it were just kind of aghast that such a thing could happen.
And many people remain aghast, and they say this young man must have been a monster. And you try to tell not only their story, but his story. And let's talk about them first. And again, you have to get used to this. You know, it's not the way we're accustomed to speaking and using our pronouns, but their gender identity was wanting to be called they. In fact, there's a story in your book about Sasha going to a bathroom and said, "I'm not either of these. I don't belong in either of these." Held it in for 6 hours.
Right. Well, Sasha's very stubborn. but yeah, Sasha identifies as agender, and Sasha has a very analytical mind, and so approached their gender identity in a way that I think is pretty different from the way most of us do, which is at some point they just began to interrogate the idea of gender and how do I know what gender I am in this very epistemological way. And
well, they even got a petition going on that, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. They did send a petition through whitehouse.gov to have non-binary individuals recognized in federal forms and so forth.
Actually, there's a major theme in your book, a major motif about binary, and everything is not black and white, and certainly everything is not black and white or male and female when it comes to the stories that you have to to tell here. And Richard's story is also, you know, a poignant one in many ways, because you look at the story on the face of it and you see the comments that people wrote on the Internet and so forth. And this is a monster and he should be punished, and he should be punished severely. But it turns out it's more complicated than that. He's in many ways a kind of sweet kid who's given to pranks and liking people, making people laugh and all of that sort of thing. Influenced, obviously, by his peers going through this limbic adolescent stage. And you try to create a whole picture of not only the environment he comes from, but who he is as an individual and this terrible act that he performed, that he does, that he commits.
Yeah, Richard, in a lot of ways, is just kind of an average kid. You know, not a great student, doesn't have a good attendance record, is pretty goofy and immature, but not a standout villain in any way, just more a kid who had some growing up to do and ran with a crowd that, you know, didn't go to school a lot.
There was a lot of truancy. In fact, he was in a group home for a while, too, because of an arrest.
Yeah.
And like a lot of kids in that part of East Oakland, troubled in his family, too. He had an amazing mother. I mean, Jasmine gave birth to him when he was 15, and you give a portrait of her as well, dedicated to working and wanting her son to succeed. And he wants to succeed for his mother. I mean, he actually likes working, and he wants to do better.
Absolutely. Richard had a lot of ambitions for himself, and his mother, Jasmine, had a lot of ambitions for him. And some of the tragedy of this story is that you see how hard it is to fulfill those ambitions, that this is a family that just underwent a number of body blows from a couple of members of the family dying violently to just the challenges of poverty and being an extremely young mother, the incarceration issue, which really affected Richard's father, who was spent a lot of Richard's life incarcerated, which had a big effect on Richard, who wanted to be with his father more. So all of those kind of social forces are acting upon this family.
And in fact, there is, some murder that comes across, not so unusual, unfortunately, in that part of Oakland. His aunt is gunned down in a drive-by. His best friend is shot to death. And very troubling things, obviously, to have to go through. He's sent to a group home, as I said, and then he gets stripped. I didn't understand this. Maybe you can help me with this, but when they talk about getting stripped, they mean essentially you're held at gunpoint and all your valuables are taken, your shoes are taken, everything, right? This was actually a friend of his, because at one point it just said he was stripped, and then later on he meets the guy who did this to him in prison and asked for his forgiveness. But at another point you say he was a friend, so
this is kind of this murky area of people you know from the neighborhood, you know, a kid he knows from around the way who, you know, he thought he was on good terms with. And so he had run into him.
So that's why he says he has a trust issue.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. You know, he thought that they were cool. And it wasn't, you know, I think he knew what this kid was about. He just didn't think it was going to be turned on him.
I want to get more into those involved in the story, including someone named Caprice, who is an important figure in Richard's life, who really tried to reform him and work with him and help him. But I'd like you maybe to read the Monday, November 4th, the opening section of your book, if you would be so kind.
Sure. Monday, November 4th, 2013. By 4:30 in the afternoon, the first mad rush of after-school passengers has come and gone. What's left are stragglers and staylaters, swiping their bus passes as they climb onto the 57 bus and take seats among the coming home workers, the shoppers and errand doers, the other students from high schools and middle schools around the city. The bus is loud, but not as loud as sometimes. A few clusters of kids are shouting and laughing, and an older woman at the front keeps talking to the driver. Dark is coming on. Daylight savings ended yesterday, and now evening rushes into the place where afternoon used to be. Everything is duskier, sleepier, wintrier now. Passengers look at their phones or stare through the scratched and grimy windows at the waning light. Sasha sits near the back. For much of the journey, the teenager has been reading a paperback copy of Anna Karenina for a class in Russian literature. Today, like most days, Sasha wears a T-shirt, a black fleece jacket, a gray flat cap, and a gauzy white skirt. A senior at a small private high school, the teenager identifies as agender, neither male nor female. As the bus lumbers through town, Sasha puts down the book and drifts into sleep, skirt draped over the edge of the seat. A few feet away, three teenage boys are laughing and joking. One of them, Richard, wears a black hoodie and an orange-billed New York Knicks hat. A 16-year-old junior at Oakland High School, he's got hazel eyes and a slow, sweet grin. He stands with his back to Sasha, gripping a pole for balance. Sasha sleeps as Richard and his companions goof around, play fighting. Sleeps as Richard's cousin Lloyd bounds up and down the aisle, flirting with a girl up front. Sleeps as Richard surreptitiously flicks a lighter and touches it to the hem of that gauzy white skirt. Wait. In a moment, Sasha will wake inside a ball of flame and begin to scream. In a moment, everything will be set in motion. Taken by ambulance to a San Francisco burn unit, Sasha will spend the next 3.5 weeks undergoing multiple surgeries to treat second and third degree burns running from calf to thigh. Arrested at school the following day, Richard will be charged with 2 felonies, each with a hate crime clause that will add time to his sentence if he is convicted. Citing the severity of the crime, the district attorney will charge him as an adult, stripping him of the protections normally given to juveniles. Before the week is out, he will be facing the possibility of life imprisonment. But none of that has happened yet. For now, both teenagers are just taking the bus home from school. Surely it's not too late to stop things from going wrong. There must be some way to wake Sasha, divert Richard, get the driver to stop the bus. There must be something you can do.
And who is that you?
The you is the reader. The you is all of us who live in this world in which kids like Sasha and kids like Richard are taking the bus home from school.
Yeah, in fact, I read an interview you did in the Chronicle where you said we all have to be aware of this and perhaps do as much as we can do or possible for us to do to not necessarily bring these worlds together, but at least recognize that they both exist and that they both have to have some kind of lack of the chasm that exists between them. The fascinating thing, as you read the prologue, of course, that comes to mind is that you realize one's in a public school, one's in a private school. There are remarkable class and racial differences between them, differences in wealth and poverty. And yet, as you move through the book, you realize that they have much in common in a strange way. They're both kind of nerdy guys, you know?
Yeah.
And not only that, but they both are good kids in a strange. I mean, it's hard for people to conceive of Richard as a good kid, especially given what he did. I mean, it stays in their mind, and I think this is very much what you wanted to convey to people. Don't keep him frozen there. He really wasn't a bad kid. But when he has hate crimes and the possibility of life imprisonment, I mean, there's everything at stake, literally everything at stake.
There's everything at stake. There's his chance to be a different person at stake. And, you know, one of the things that I think you see in this narrative is that Richard knew that there was a script prepared for him, and he did not want to follow that script. And, you know, his struggle is to try and figure out how to take a different path. And that remains his struggle because, you know, he's going to get out.
Which some feel he should not,
which some people may feel he should not, but he will, as do 97% of all people who are incarcerated in this country. He will get out. And so the question is, you know, does he get to take a different path then?
But the reason that hate crimes came into this, and you have a good deal of your narrative devoted to the nature of hate crimes, and I mean, there was a lot of concern about gangs and concern about crack cocaine and all of these things sort of hyped it up. The reality was that Richard was being interrogated, and you go into very good narrative detail about that interrogation, by the way, a white cop and a black cop. And they used to ask him how he feels about homosexuals. And he's, you know, a kid from a black community. I'm homophobic. I don't like gays. I mean, which would be almost predictable in some respects for a lot of those kids because gays are sissies. And, you know, they talk about them in these pejorative ways. And later on, it turns out he may not even know what homophobic means, but this is something he relates to the police officer. So it suddenly becomes exacerbated by hate crime legislation.
Yeah. And, you know, to be clear, there's a way in which this is accurate in that Sasha would not have been picked out of the crowd if Sasha dressed like everybody else.
And had not been wearing a skirt.
And so, you know, it's important not to, you know, gloss over the fact that Sasha was targeted for being gender nonconforming. And so the tricky part is trying to figure out, well, what does that say about a person who is a teenager? You know, we expect that adults are going to have more mature views on things, and that an adult who, you know, targets somebody in a violent way because of the way they manifest their gender has had a chance to arrive at better views. But I'm not sure that we can have that same expectation for a kid, for a 16-year-old kid.
Well, in fact, there's a reference in your book to support that came from behalf of not only the ACLU, which would be expected, but National Center for Lesbian Rights and Transgender Law on behalf of Richard. And there was a lot of support within the community. And one of the most moving and poignant things is the support that came for Sasha. I mean, not only from classmates, there's mysterious three ladies who come to every single court hearing that he has. And I found that very moving.
The three ladies are...
not only the three ladies, but all the support he had, you know, from the community.
All the support that Sasha had.
Yes.
Yeah, it was very moving. And I think it meant a tremendous amount to Sasha to get all this support from all over the world. People who just took it upon themselves to write a letter or send a gift or something to say, you know, we support you and we want you to be able to walk through the world safely.
There's also the story I mentioned before about Caprice, who had a tough upbringing, often associated with East Oakland, as you point out. She has a close friend, a guy who actually she wants to get pregnant by and maybe married, named Little Jerry, who gets wasted and gets killed, as happens to so many young black men in East Oakland. And yet she is able to turn herself on a totally different path, becomes almost a mother figure and figure to, and really wants to help Richard deeply.
Yeah, Caprice is a lot of people's favorite character in the whole book because her story is so interesting. And she is an incredible force in the Oakland Public Schools to this day. Really has an ability to connect with kids who often don't find an adult to connect with in school, kids who are pretty troubled, and she gets them. And she was a huge supporter of Richard's and was somebody who made a very key connection with him as he was trying to, you know, find that other path that I talked about earlier.
There is, at this point, first of all, hate crimes, going back to that for a minute, as you point out in the book, the numbers are down, right?
Well, the numbers were down then when the book was written. Of course, we have a new situation now.
With transgender people, you mean?
With transgender people, with Muslim people, with African Americans. I mean, the fact is that we now have a society that is increasingly afflicted with bias-related violence because we have a president who seems to be encouraging that way of behaving and that way of thinking.
Well, we also have numbers down, though, for crimes of black youth. That is still consistent, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. Our crime rate has been going down steadily since the mid-1990s.
And you kind of make a case here as you weave through your narrative for restorative justice. I think in many ways, I mean, you tell a whole story of a guy who's grabbing girls, like apparently George Bush, our former president, George Bush I, has been doing from his wheelchair, but grabbing girls by their rear ends. And the upshot of it is that restorative justice works. They wanted it to work for Richard. Some did, yeah?
Yeah, there were people on both sides of this crime, advocates for Sasha and advocates for Richard, who really believed that this was a case that could benefit from restorative justice, that both of these families had the capacity to be compassionate for one another. And that's kind of the step one of restorative justice, is being willing to engage in that kind of process. Restorative justice is generally not used as an alternative to sentencing for a crime of this magnitude. And that was the DA's position, was that this was too serious a crime to use restorative justice as a way to divert Richard out of the criminal justice system.
So DA of Alameda County we're talking
Correct,
about.
Correct, Nancy O'Malley.
The odds of landing in the back of a police cruiser, you're right, on the other hand, were much better than the dreams that Richard might have had of escaping. African-American boys made up less than 30% of Oakland's underage population, but accounted for nearly 75% of all juvenile arrests. And then the likelihood of serving time and all the rest of that. It's, you know, where you get this kind of point-counterpoint is Richard's going through the legal process here, and Sasha is suffering in the hospital and going through all these graftings and surgeries and so forth, and you realize the consequences, and the consequences afflict so many others who are around them, so many people who are in the orbits of their lives. I mean, I said they were both similar in some ways. They both had close friends, you know, really almost kind of an extended family of friends who had many things in common with them. And the whole notion, though, in many people's minds that he was doing this maybe as a prank in his mind, or of course the police say, what was in your mind? He says, nothing, nothing. You know, he's trying to make his friends laugh or something else, is heinous. I mean, you know, a lot of people simply can't internalize that. The deed is so heinous that terrible punishment should go with it.
Absolutely. And fire, I think, evokes a very visceral response in us.
Especially now in the Bay Area.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, that was part, I think, of why people had such a vitriolic response was, you know, that fire is just a terrifying thing. And we do see in the book that, it's nobody wants to go to a burn unit.
Can I say something else that really moved me in this book? It was this guy named Dan Gale, construction worker. He saves Sasha, and he's just such a, he comes across, at least in your narrative, as such a self-effacing guy, and a guy who says, you know, it's the least I could have done type of thing that you really, and there's also these letters that Richard wrote. It didn't come into public eye until 14 months after he had been incarcerated, but the letters are extraordinary, compelling.
The letters are really beautiful. And, you know, as a reporter, I had heard about these letters from the first day that I started reporting. And I was so curious to see them and also, you know, didn't know for sure that they existed because his lawyer said there are letters and but I can't show them to you because they contain an admission of guilt.
All right, hold that thought, because I have to invite listeners, and I know listeners would love to talk to you and would like to get on the record here about their thoughts and their feelings. This is a case that, as I said, generated international attention, and you may want to let us know your thoughts, or you may simply want to have questions for our guest. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us right now at that toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also be part of this conversation by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. We'll continue with Dashka Slater, who's here with us in studio. Her book, The 57 Bus, Two Sides of the Same Crime, Two Ends of the Same Line. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Dashka Slater, who is a reporter and an author and a journalist. She's written a book called The 57 Bus. It's about the event that occurred a number of years ago on the 57 bus in Oakland when a young agender person who identified as agender was set on fire by a young African-American boy from East Oakland. We're going to go to your calls and emails forthwith, and if you would like to join us, you can do so by calling us at 866-733-6786 or emailing us forum@kqed.org or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum. And let me go to a comment on the website and get your response, Dashka Slater, because this is certainly understandable, this kind of sentiment. This is Livery who writes, I'm sick of hearing how damaged these people are. Setting another human being on fire for nothing more than amusement is sociopathic and deeply evil.
Yeah, a lot of people felt that way.
Can understand it. Can't
yeah, you? Absolutely. In the book, you see a little bit more how the whole thing unfolded and how little forethought there was. I had an interesting experience. Last week, I was at a high school in Nevada talking to some kids about this book. And when I got to the part about the fire, the teacher said, you guys, see, I keep telling you, you know, I see you all the time bringing lighters to school and trying to set each other's hair on fire. And this is what happens. And I thought, that's what it is that as adults, we think, who would do that? That's so crazy and so stupid.
Because we don't know how the adolescent brain works. You go into some detail about that in your book.
Exactly. Okay. But it's a fairly common thing for kids to do, actually.
Well, Sasha's mother, Debbie Crandall, is on the phone with us, and I'd like to bring her into this conversation. Debbie Crandall, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Hi.
First question, Sasha, or used to be Luke, now it's Emily, is at MIT. How are they doing?
They are doing great. They're in their senior year, and they'll be graduating soon. So, yeah, they're very happy there and thriving. It's been great.
And I'd like your response to, I mean, there were many people who understandably felt when your child was literally set on fire that the perpetrator of that deed was evil and should have been punished severely and much more perhaps than one would normally mete out in the way of punishment in our criminal justice system for juveniles.
Yes. Well, when it happened, all of our focus was really on seeing that Sasha Emily, recovered and had our support. We did, and my first feeling was, you know, we didn't know if he was crazy, if he was doing it out of hate. We didn't know what it was. We didn't know anything about Richard, really. And you know, my first response is, we just don't want this to happen to anyone again. To have a crazy person out there. So feeling like
he should be locked up, right?
Yeah. And we also knew it was a kid, and, you know, we just didn't know the whole story. It was very frustrating. We didn't really see those letters that he wrote until 14 months later. And we, at that point, I just felt a lot of compassion for him. We also had met Jasmine, and I felt so much compassion for him.
His mother.
For Richard's mother, because I felt like we had so much support around us. Everybody was for Sasha and supporting him and supporting us. And Jasmine was suffering this horrible thing that had happened, you know, that her son being arrested and what he had done. And, you know, who was there for her is what I thought about a lot.
So may I ask you how you feel about Richard now?
I feel like it was a prank that went wrong. I feel like I've forgiven him, that it was just a terrible mistake that he made. He was egged on by other kids to do it. And I didn't want to see him become another, another black kid that disappears into the criminal justice system and comes out even more damaged than, you know. So from what I hear that he's doing well in his in jail, and I'm glad to hear that. And I'm hoping that he really can make a life for himself when he gets out.
Well, I think that's kind and generous of you. I just want to ask you about something else, though, that came mm-hmm. up in the book. It's a story that has stayed in my mind about when you and your husband, Carl, took Sasha to a therapist at age 7. And mm-hmm. and could you tell that story? Because I think it's very revealing.
Well, Sasha was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, which is now autism. I mean, it's on the autism spectrum. And we took him to a therapist, and the therapist did the tests and let us know, yes, he has Asperger's.
But you're still calling him.
I know.
See, again, even the mother can't help it.
No, so,
you don't have to apologize
to me. Everybody gives me a hard time about that. So
well,
sorry.
Actually, the guy I mentioned who saved his life, man, dude, he was calling him those words.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
But anyway, and the doctor, Dr. Lopez, said, oh, yes, I've worked with many kids that have Asperger's syndrome, and none of them ever get married. And, you know, you'll be lucky if Sasha is able to get a job as a data processor. And and it was just so depressing to me. I mean, here was a 7-year-old kid, and this doctor had just pronounced that they were going to be this failure in life, and they were, you know, they might not ever have a loving relationship, they might not ever have a meaningful job, and it was so distressing to me, and so we stopped seeing him, that doctor, and it, you know, and Sasha went to MIT, and they. Emily goes by she or they now. So, well, they're doing great.
That's great to hear, and yeah. It's great for you to spend the time with us. I'm much appreciative of it, and good luck to you and your family. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's Debbie Crandall, mother of Sasha and now Emily. Let me go back. We're going to go to some calls here in just a moment, but let me go back, Dashka Slater, to you just for a couple of things. And one is, you tell the story here of Donald Williams, African-American at San Jose State, who many people remember this story. His roommates, they had a noose, and they locked him up, and they used the N-word and all kinds of terrible things. And again, seemed like it was more, in their mind, pranks. And they were charged with misdemeanors. They weren't charged with felonies.
They were not charged with felonies. They were charged with two hate crime enhancements as well, I believe, or at least one count. And so I include that story in the book because I want readers to really grapple with this question of when is it a prank and when is it a crime? Does the age of the person who commits the prank or crime matter, and so forth, because it is often an excuse that people make when they make a remark that's hurtful or do something that's harmful to say, well, I was just joking. And, you know, that's, I think, not acceptable as a overarching excuse.
I had also mentioned earlier the media's role in this. There's actually a kind of a moment of levity when they keep referring to the skirt as a kilt. And the next thing you do is expect to see Sasha with bagpipes or something because of all this reference to a kilt. It's as if they were swarming around him. It was like paparazzi.
Yeah, it's the case almost instantly attracted international attention. Again, because fire is such a, I think, evokes such a visceral response. Somehow as it moved through the wire services and so forth, the initial description was that it was a kilt-like garment. And I believe it was the Daily Mail that included even like a picture of a kilt and, you know, said that it was the national dress of Scotland when the story went out in their paper.
Let's bring our callers in, and we begin with a caller from Berkeley. Brenda, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to say two things. One, this is a comment. I don't think lighters should be allowed in high school if what she's saying is true, and I'm sure it is. There's no reason for kids to have lighters. They're underage. They can't smoke. Lighters should be forbidden in high schools, period.
Well, you could use certainly a metal detector to find out if there's a lighter.
Yeah, I think the point at that school was just that kids do stupid and dangerous things and things that are forbidden all the time. And when I was a kid, it was very the fashionable prank was a hot foot. Where you'd hold up a lighter to somebody's foot and wait for them to feel the burn. So, you know, obviously as adults, we know that that's dangerous, but kids often don't.
And I thank you for the call. Sorry to bring this up, but I remember guys trying to light flatulence. You know, that was also the sort of thing that was not uncommon among youth in my period of life. Robert is our next caller. Robert, good morning.
Yeah. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I just want to say when I was in high school, and that's quite about almost 50 years ago, I was walking by this guy, and he was getting ready to sit down, and I pulled a chair out from underneath him, and he fell flat on his butt. And I knew it hurt. He was a friend of mine, and I felt so bad about it. I even told him, if you want to take a slug at me, I won't stop it. I'll let you hit me, because I felt so bad about it. And I don't know what overcame me that made me do that. But I can understand how sometimes just in a fleeting moment, we do stupid things. And I don't think those things should follow us for the rest of our lives. I mean, it's following me and my conscience, but I'm not paying any other consequence as a result of that.
Okay. I'm glad you shared your story with us, Robert, and I thank you for that. And here's another one from Roberto, who writes, I have a cousin who lit our friend's hair on fire when we were teenagers. She was wearing lots of hairspray, and it went up faster than my cousin could have imagined. I've seen it happen several times, always a teen thinking it was a funny joke. I do understand how a teen could underestimate the impact of such a foolish act, and I understand how dangerous it is for our whole society to stand by passively as even the leaders of our current federal government work passionately to reduce the humanity of our LGBTQ communities. Let's do better for all the Sashas and Richards of our world. And Susan wants to know, why did you choose to write this book for young adults, and why do you hope the audience, what do you hope the audience will take away from it?
The whole time I was working on this story for the New York Times Magazine, I had this fantasy in my mind of writing it for young adults because I felt like the topic was something that would be so interesting to them because it's, you know, two teenage protagonists and because it deals with race and gender and class and justice and all the issues of our time. And so I am also in my other life a children's book writer. And so my editor for one of my picture books got in touch with me. And it turned out that she had the same take, that it would be a great book for young adults. I had
know something? As an adult, not so young anymore, yeah. I thought it was a really damn good read. I mean, you know, it has a great narrative flow to it. And it has some things that you don't usually see in a book of this sort, you know, the text messages, the actual text messages, Facebook comments, all the stuff on social media. And you threw in some of your own poetry here, which at first surprised me. I didn't know what to make of that.
Yeah, one of the great things about writing for young adults is that the world of young adult literature is very experimental and its genre mashups are very common. And in a book that was sort of about getting off the binary, I was interested in having it have kind of a genre mashup feel to it. So to deal with a narrative issue of wanting to have some of my own voice in there but not wanting to be a character in the story, I put in some poems.
And we're talking, if you just joined us, with Dashka Slater. Her book is called The 57 Bus. And let me go to more of your calls. Let me go next to, is it Tune In?
Toonman in Oak, in Alameda.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, good morning. I really appreciate Dashka's work. I can relate it to it very personally. I wanted to offer some observations. I used to write number 57 as well and got robbed several times and saw many incidences of bullying and pranksterning and robberies, even in fact. But, you know, we are a loquacious society. And adolescents are coming of age to being loquacious. But this social phenomenon has a lot of terminology which are imprecise, fast, and loose. I am one that would posit that it's not a crime to hate. What Richard did was definitely not a prank. A prank is amongst a close-knit clique. It's a social crime. And but it's not a crime to hate. I myself am from Burma, and we have an enduring hate of the British with their legacy of colonialism. I understand Algerians have a right to hate Frenchmen for what they did historically, but I am not allowed to take my hate and express it in a manner that's inappropriate. I think there has to be dialogue and negotiations. It's not a crime, even I would posit, in Charlottesville to hate. But what's called now with the loquacious terminology terrorism, it's adequately described by standard terminology. Mass murder and mayhem should suffice. So with that.
All right, sir. I thank you for those comments and appreciate hearing from you. The whole attempt to define semantically hate on legal terms is also kind of a wasp nest, isn't it?
It is, and it's interesting to me as I looked into hate crime legislation and the use of these sentencing enhancements, which is what they are. It turns out that it's actually pretty hard to get a conviction with a hate crime, and they're often used to kind of jack up the peril that a defendant feels and then move closer to a plea bargain or to give a jury a selection of routes that they can go. But I think the important thing to focus on is that they are sentencing enhancements, which means that what we're saying is that the cure or the remedy for having hateful feelings and acting in a hateful way is to go to prison, which, as we know, is filled with hate and race-based gangs and many viewpoints and antisocial behaviors that we disapprove of. And so I'm not sure that it's really the best remedy for being hateful is to go be with more hateful people.
And also, of course, prison is a university of crime, all kind of violence and things that go on behind bars we're all too well aware of. But you talk about the myth of the super predator. You know, a lot of that was, again, let's get tough on violence. There are too many drive-bys, this sort of thing. And give us some statistics here. Say, in 2012 analysis by California's Department of Justice found that cases against black youths were more than twice as likely to be directly filed in adult court cases than against white youths. And cases against Latino youths were more than six times as likely. And the disparity didn't end there. Once they landed in adult court, young black and brown offenders were almost much more likely to serve time. So although hate crimes was initially, I think, and you kind of point this out in an explicit way in your book, an attempt by people who are progressive and liberal to make sure there was more punishment for those who were assaulting and taking their bigotry out on people who were more marginalized, it's kind of turned around the other way.
Well, it's one of those places where people on the left end up taking a position that is contrary to the position that they take on other issues. In other words, people who are proponents of hate crime legislation then find themselves also indirectly being proponents of incarceration, which they often oppose in other cases. So it is a wasp's nest. It's difficult to find what the ethical path is through these various social issues, you know, can be.
We'll take some more of your calls. Let me go next to you, Patrice in Oakland. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you, Dashka, for writing this book and for drawing attention to what happened to Sasha, now Emily, and what happened to Richard. I think it's really important. But I do want to talk about hate crime laws and how important they are and how long people across this country fought to have this recognition of the terror that takes place when people are targeted because of their identity, and how important it is for vulnerable, particularly transgender people at this moment, to have this recognition. And I don't think that, you know, by saying that we're going to have hate crime laws, that we don't recognize the need for restorative justice and the kind of justice that we were hoping, I think, someone like Richard would receive in this context and in this case and in many cases. But having hate crime laws on the books is so important now because people are being harmed at an unprecedented level. And to say that this is something that, quote unquote, the left wanted, I think is really going to confuse the issue in this moment when we need the justice system to understand that people who are targeted by hate need protection under the law.
I think we're in agreement on that, aren't we, Dashka?
Absolutely. The question, I think, is what do we do next? You know, that we have this instrument, which is the criminal justice system, and it's very good at passing down judgment, and it's not very good at figuring out what to do with people once their case has been adjudicated. And we know that more than 95% of the people who go into some kind of incarceration in this country will come out. And so we have to be focusing on what are they going to be like when they return to society.
And let me thank Patrice for the call. I was going to say something about the fact that both Richard and Sasha were exposed to violence in different ways. I mean, there's violence against transgender people. Obviously, there's violence within the black community against black people, against Richard personally. But let me just read a comment and get your response to it. It's from Kali, who writes, I found it quite hard to hear apologies for Richard's behavior when so many, I don't know if anybody's been apologizing, when so many people on this program can't handle Sasha's, Emily's pronouns. It sounds dismissive, like you too see something wrong with gender nonconforming people. Perhaps that's part of why a teenager might see so little issue in targeting a trans person for random violence.
Pronouns are challenging for people. And I don't think that we're seeing a lot of dismissiveness. I feel like I've spent more than 3 years working on this story, almost four at this point. And so I've gotten pretty fluent with Sasha's pronouns, which is not to say that I don't make errors at times, but I'm pretty good at it. But I've had some time to learn.
I think we were laughing like Sasha's mother was laughing at just how much conditioned we are not to using them. It's not to make fun or ridicule, and I think that's harsh. But let me read another comment. Tom writes, you have written a moving, compassionate, and balanced portrayal of these two young people. Could you think back to what impressions went through your mind about these two people when you first heard about the crime, and now, years later, what have been some of the most surprising things you have learned about them both?
I started out knowing a little bit less than I wrote in the prologue. It was kind of the bare bones of the case. And it was very, very close to home to me. The crime took place in my neighborhood. Richard's high school is my neighborhood high school. Sasha's family lives quite close to me. So it felt very personal. And of course, my first reaction was horror that this had happened. My own kid took the 57 bus home from school. So, you know, it was, you know, very, very close to me. And at the same time, I had some curiosity about both of these two kids. I didn't know what agender meant, and I was curious to find out. And I was curious, as the parent of a teenager, whether it was possible to judge somebody as irredeemable at the age of 16, whether any views that you have. And at that point, I didn't know what Richard was like or whether he was motivated by intense hatred or anything. You know, but presuming that he was a hate-filled person, did that mean that he was going to be that way for the rest of his life if given a chance? And so what I discovered was that Richard's case was much more complex than I had thought it might be, and that Sasha's gender journey was much more complex than I could ever have imagined, that their thinking about gender was at this level of sophistication that I didn't even know was possible.
I have to ask you, because it did occur to me in reading the book, when the two letters are, as we said, are poignant. In fact, I wouldn't even use the word eloquent. You know, please forgive me. I take full responsibility. I did something terribly wrong. I think about it all the time. I care about you. Was he coached? Do we know? Because it would have helped, certainly, in a courtroom situation.
If those letters had ever been...
They never got into it.
So it's a good question. And I did spend some time looking into this and trying to figure out whether there was some coaching. And what I have learned, of course, you know, I wasn't there, so you never know what you don't know. But to the best of my understanding, these letters were actually written by Richard before he had a lawyer, and when he really just had a lot of time to sit by himself and panic about what was going on and to feel all the feelings you feel when you know that you've done something really wrong.
And could you also talk a little bit about, there was tension between his mother Jasmine and his lawyer Du Bois?
Yeah, there was.
What was that over mainly?
Communication. I think that it was, I don't want to get too much into it, but, you know, when your child is facing such incredible jeopardy, you want to really know that you understand what's going to happen. And when you're a criminal defense lawyer with a huge caseload, you only have a certain amount of time available to explain things. And you know, I don't know who was in the right or anything like that, you know, but I do know that that was the point of their conflict.
We've got another caller, and that's Erica. Erica, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, thank you. I thank you for the book, and I want to thank Sasha's mother for her graciousness and her strength in calling into the show. We should all strive to be as human and thoughtful as she is.
And thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. Indeed, a lot of people come off really well here. I mean, you read your book and you do come away with hope, especially all the support that Sasha got and all the support that Richard got and the attempt to try to really help them and come to their aid and come to them out of compassion. And hesitantly use the word, but love, really.
Yeah, somebody, a reviewer wrote that for a book about a hate crime, the book has a surprising amount of love in it. And I think that's really true. There are really very few, if any, hateful people in this story, and a lot of people who try to find a way to be good-hearted and kind.
Dashka Slater, thank you for the book, and thank you for spending this time with us.
Thank you for having me.
The book, again, is The 57 Bus, and Dashka Slater is a journalist, a children's book author, and author of the book. And the subtitle is A True Story of Two Teenagers and the Crime That Changed Their Lives. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauberg, and Susan Britton. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineers are Danny Bringer and Steve Asrigato. And our engagement producers are Amanda Stupai. We get online support from Amanda Font. Interns are Anna Sterla and Patrick Fitzgerald. Managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. Our executive producer is Holly Kernan. Thank you for being a part of the program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.